Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man of considerable intelligence, whom we have the privilege of visiting with periodically, is one of my colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, John Rossomondo. It's Senior Analyst for Defense Policy, and he has a background in investigative journalism and has worked as a counterterrorism analyst for Steve Emerson's highly regarded investigative project on terrorism. And these days, he is keeping a bead on what is going on with our national security, particularly our armed forces, and the larger problem of our critical dependency upon rare earth minerals, among other things, that are vital to our military's ability to perform its vital missions. We're anxious to catch up with him about both topics. John, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Good to have you with us.
Thanks a lot, Frank. I'm glad to be back with you.
Let me ask you first, John, about the state of the military. There is a growing body of evidence, and Tucker Carlson has, I think, very helpfully pointed out some of it, that we're seeing a kind of wrecking operation taking place against our armed forces. He mentioned the other day in his monologue that we now have a diversity officer in charge of recruitment and training, apparently, for the special forces in the Special Operations Command. This would be just one indicator of a considerable misplaced priority, it seems to me, within our armed forces. And I have the feeling it speaks to a larger problem. What's your sense of that, John?
My sense is that the military under Joe Biden is more interested in settling political or scores and pitting people against each other based on their sex or their political orientations and race than they are about winning wars. You can't win a war, if you have a white person and a black person in the same foxhole, and the other person considers the other supposed to be their teammate, their enemy. I mean, it just doesn't work. It just seems to me that they're focusing on things that will undermine readiness. And will cause people who are well qualified to leave the military. I seem to remember, years ago, before they allowed gays in the military, the talking point was not allowing gays and kicking them out of the military would undermine readiness. So if we're kicking conservatives out, how is that not undermining readiness?
Especially as there are a lot more conservatives, at least historically, in the military than there are homosexuals. John, two things really worry me about this. One is that most civilians don't have any appreciation of the importance of the culture of the military to its esprit de corps, its morale, and as you say, its readiness. And to the extent that they're, taking a wrecking ball to the culture by this critical race theory craziness and all that flows from it, I really fear that they're doing irreparable harm to it. And as you say, there is an option for people in an all-volunteer force to stop volunteering. And we may wind up really short of the kind of high-quality people that we need, because typically those are the ones who go elsewhere and can readily find other employment, though they want to serve, not under these circumstances. Are those concerns misplaced?
No, they're not. In the military, you're not an individual. The Biden administration wants to emphasize the individual at the expense of the larger unit. An army is not, in one individual or another individual. Like, say, if they're working at Boeing or if they're working, at the Center for Security Policy, for example. According to, you know, I'll just quote, von Clausewitz, the great Prussian military strategist, morale is everything. I mean, how can we defeat the Chinese if we can't, we don't even know why we're fighting? I mean, historically.
Or what we're fighting for.
Exactly. I mean, von Clausewitz said that war is about forcing the other side to bend your will. What is our will? I mean, we fought for freedom, for democracy, for the American way. Well, now the American way is being told to the younger generation it's evil, it's racist, it's so forth. I mean, the closest thing I could think of is the, maybe like the Soviet military after the purges in the 1930s when they had their behinds handed to them by the Nazis.
Yeah, big time. John, this is such important work. And I really hope that we can drill down on it intensively, because I believe that at the end of the day, the men and women in uniform don't have the freedom of speech that the rest of us do. They defend ours, to be sure. But as you say, they're subordinated to a chain of command and so on. And they need folks like us to speak up for them, because what they're doing is vital work and we need to support them in doing it, not take them down. Let me turn quickly to something else that you've recently written on, John, at the National Interest. China's monopoly on rare earth minerals is a critical national security risk, is a headline of your piece. Very quickly talk about it. We're going to visit more about it with Kevin Freeman in a moment, but give us your sense of just how much of a national security risk do we face at the moment in this regard?
Well, if you look at our high-tech military, everything that we have, has a screen in it. Whether you're on a Virginia-class submarine, whether you're on an F-35, they all contain these rare earth minerals that China has an 80% control on. And just imagine the impact to readiness, Frank, if the Chinese were all of a sudden to decide that they were going to stop selling it. I mean, President Trump, to his credit, identified this as a problem in the waning days of his administration and signed an executive order last September calling on the Defense Department to find other sources. Currently, it just signed a contract last month with an Australian firm to begin a processing facility in Texas. But, we need to work at buying up mines in places like Burma, places like Malaysia, sub-Saharan Africa, anywhere that they exist, that's owned by the United States government for use of the U.S. Defense industry. We can't allow our worst enemy to be in control of vital resources for our military.
Amen. John, we have to leave it at that for the moment. This is a topic to which we will return, I'm afraid. The Chinese have stolen a march on us and are in most of those places already and are locking down those vital resources. But you're right to raise a flag about it. We need focused effort in this area as well. We look forward to visiting with you more about it. Thanks for the work you do at the Center for Security Policy. I know you'll keep it up and come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman, our duty expert on economic warfare, about this rare earth mineral dependency and much more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit inside the Economic War Room with its proprietor, Kevin Freeman. That is, of course, the title of his terrific television program made available through Blaze TV, but you can find it elsewhere as well, notably at economicwarroom.com. Kevin is also the author of two terrific best-selling books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, and a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, I'm very proud to say, and a regular here at Secure Freedom Radio. We're delighted to have him always. Welcome back, Kevin.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be with you.
I was talking with John Rossomondo in the previous segment about a topic that I know you've given a lot of thought to as well, Kevin, and that is our critical dependency on our enemy, the Chinese Communist Party, for lots of things. You were the one who first put me on to Rosemary Gibson's warnings which she conveyed initially in her terrific book, China RX, about our dependency on China for medicine. And we've learned in the COVID era about our dependency on them for medical protective equipment and other devices. And John's pointing to our dependency on them for something that's indispensable to, well, both our commercial sector, but also our military, namely these rare earth minerals. Tell us a little bit about them and how we got ourselves into a position where the Chinese control, by his estimate, 80% of the market in those critical materials.
Well, first, rare earth minerals, it's somewhat of a misnomer. They're not incredibly rare. They're difficult to obtain, and it involves complex mining processes. And in the United States, we've decided we did not want to go through that for the environmental impact or whatever other reasons. But you can get rare earth minerals in California right now, not legally, but they're obtainable. But the Chinese saw this, and they saw that so much of our modern life is dependent on those, whether it's semiconductors or whether it's flat screen TVs or electric cars or whatever. And they chose to do two things. One, develop their own capabilities, and two, to encourage environmental groups to protest the development of any other nation's capabilities. They call it resources warfare, and they've laid it out in the book Unrestricted Warfare 22 years ago now, where they said resources warfare means gaining control of scarce natural resources and being able to control or manipulate their access and market value. They've made us dependent on them. It's been purposed, just like they did with pharmaceuticals.
And we've seen, in the case of Japan a few years ago, them weaponizing it by denying the Japanese access to their rare earth minerals with very deleterious effects, as I recall, on the Chinese automotive industry, among other things. Is that right?
That is true. But the Japanese had a response, and they began developing rare earth capabilities on their own. So Japan realized that that was a threat and responded logically. Yes, absolutely.
Kevin, let me switch gears. There is a story that we've been covering now for several days, initially with Lance Crayon, about the Chinese retaliation against a Swedish retailer of clothing by the name of H&M that had some 500 plus stores in China and is now under severe assault, economic warfare, think of the first order, by China, for having the temerity to say it would not allow products sold in its store to be made of cotton obtained from Xinjiang, a province where the Chinese are producing an enormous amount of it with forced labor, part of their genocide against the Uyghur population there and other ethnic minorities. I don't know if you've been following this story, but they've gone to considerable lengths to essentially neutralize or vaporize is perhaps a better term for it, this large concern. And as Lance Crayon put it, the old Chinese adage, kill the chicken to scare the monkey, seems to be operating here, where they're trying to make it clear that everybody else better avoid making this same mistake or suffer similar kinds of repercussions at the Chinese Communist Party's hands. Your thoughts?
Well, first off, H&M is woke, and in this case with valid reason, because forced labor should never be used to produce cotton for materials or anything else. So they're woke. Here's the irony, though. All of the woke American companies that Larry Fink and others are investing in here in the United States, whether it be H&M or whatever, all of those companies that are woke that have reasons similar to this and in many cases less valid, he's investing in them but giving a pass to the Chinese government. Why should China be exempt from international standards? They continue to do this, whether it's in accounting terms, whether it is in woke standards. They're continually given a pass, or environmental issues. They produce more carbon than any other nation on the planet. This is a problem. The Chinese government, number one, is demanding everyone else be woke, everyone else comply with the standards, and they're exempting themselves, and we're letting them do it. And this is a serious problem. We need to wake up. We need to see what's going on here. This is another reason to divest from our investments in China. They are not good for the planet. It's not the Chinese people. Don't get me wrong. The Chinese people are wonderful people, but the Chinese Communist Party is forcing their landlords to evict H&M, their people to boycott H&M, all because H&M dared to point out the hypocrisy of the Chinese Communist Party. And I think this should be a major, major story. People need to be talking about this, but it harkens back to the issue that we had with the NBA, where the NBA is supporting China at the same time that they're not willing to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. They're not willing to support the United States and so forth. So this is a big story.
It is a big story. And you're right. We're watching in this case, among many others, the enabling of some of this behavior by the Chinese, by Western capitalists who are perfectly prepared to do business with them, even when they are engaged in genocide and other horrific acts. Kevin, let me talk about economic warfare here at home. You were a driving force behind a terrific effort after the 2020 elections called Every Legal Vote. And you helped the rest of us really learn a lot about what went wrong in that election and what mustn't be allowed to be done again. We unfortunately saw some of that done again in the runoff elections in the state of Georgia. The state legislature finally bestirred itself in recent days to enact legislation that tries to prevent some of the abuses that brought us, I believe, electoral grand larceny at the presidential race and in these two Senate runoffs as well, and perhaps others in the state. They're now being targeted for very aggressive economic and political pressure to reverse course, to abandon this effort to assure future electoral integrity in Georgia. Talk about what's going on there and the stakes.
Well, what's happening is that American corporations have decided that they're more important than the people of the United States, that they're what they believe and what they think is more valuable and more important. They were in no way involved when California decided that they were going to allow ballot harvesting. They thought that California has a right to allow ballot harvesting. Why? Because it agrees with their political viewpoint. These corporations had no problem with the idea that someone could go into a nursing home and literally bully an elderly resident into voting a certain way. Now, we're not worried about that. But they have a big problem that Georgia wants to have a voter ID. When you show up to vote, Georgia wants your ID to be checked. And if you vote absentee, they want to know that you have an ID. Oh, that's, disenfranchisement of voters and everything else. No. What they're wanting is they're wanting their political agenda to be crammed through the United States without the will of the people. In other words, the corporations and what they think is more important than what the voters and their representatives in Georgia believe. And that is, it's just on the edge of evil that our corporations are taking over our government and our country. And if you don't comply, you get punished. It's exactly the same thing that the Communist Party in China is doing. You have to comply with what they believe in every respect. You can't even worry about where your cotton comes from. I don't want cotton sheets from slave labor. And in Georgia, the corporations are exercising that same authoritarian control, attempting to bully Georgia into denying the will of the duly elected legislature and the people.
Yeah, this goes back to that woke sort of agenda that you were referring to earlier, Kevin. And you're right, whether it's in the service of the Chinese Communist Party or whether it's in the service of a sort of totalitarian agenda here at home, well, I believe there's actually support for it from Communist China as well, including in the state of Georgia, based on Trevor Loudon's great research into what the CCP had done to try to register voters who would help flip Georgia from red to blue back in the last election cycle. Kevin, this is really important work, and I think it's vital that as you do each week, Economic War Room, that you help the rest of us understand these sorts of agendas and the extent to which they are mutating, or as Barack Obama liked to say, fundamentally transforming our country out from under us, and how we can best both call it out and resist it, because if we love freedom and it's on the line, especially if one of the other upshots of all of this is a major push, I'm told, not next week, but the week following, behind this idea of jamming H.R. 1 or S.1, as it's known in the Senate, this electoral hijacking legislation, which will deny states like Georgia and every others from having their own independent say in what is done to assure the that, as you put it, Kevin, every legal vote counts. This is very bad business. And again, we appreciate so much what you do at Economic War Room and your visits with us next week. We'll talk with you again in the next one. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Sam Faddis, who has been doing some very interesting work on, among other things, the WHO investigation, which tells us the Chinese Communist Party didn't have anything to do with this virus. We'll get to the bottom of this right after a short break. Stay tuned.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back and joined once again by another of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, I'm proud to say, Charles Sam Faddis. I think of him as a quintessential Renaissance man who has served his country both in the uniform of the United States Army and out of uniform in the undercover operations world of the Central Intelligence Agency. He's also served in Washington State as an assistant attorney general. He's also run for Congress in Maryland. He has written extensively, among other places, at andmagazine.com, his great online resource, and a couple of important books, including Beyond Repair, a nonfiction work about the decline and fall of the Central Intelligence Agency. Sam, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Today, as we speak, the World Health Organization will trot out an investigation, or the results of it, to the source of the coronavirus epidemic that I prefer to call the CCP virus, the Chinese Communist Party virus, which tells you where I think it came from. We are getting pretty clear indications that they're going to say there was no connection to either the Chinese Communist Party or to a laboratory that has become somewhat notorious, the Wuhan Institute of Virology in Wuhan, China. Talk about this. You've investigated things for a living for quite some time. What do you make of what we know of this investigation and its seeming findings?
Right. Well, assuming that those findings are going to be as you described them, which I think is very, very likely. I mean, these are ridiculous. Hogwash would be the polite form. And look, you know, calling something an investigation does not make it so, right? If you are allowed to go on the ground and talk to people in a setting where they're free to speak to you and allowed to go where you want to go and look at the things you want to, and you have the right motivations, yeah, you can get to the bottom of something.
In a timely fashion.
Yeah, and if you're led around by the nose, and if by the way, the agency that shows up doesn't really have any motivation to get to the bottom of everything, it's just looking to whitewash the whole deal, well, then you're going to end up with something called an investigation, and it's nothing of the sort. So that's what we're looking at. We're going to read a report which is a propaganda piece effectively drafted by the CCP. That's all we're going to look at. It's meaningless.
Yeah, nothing to see here, folks. Not only is the agency that is bringing us this travesty, the World Health Organization, compromised by the Chinese Communist Party, as you know, Sam Faddis, but so is the United States government. And at AND Magazine, you really laid out a bill of particulars, starting with the President of the United States, in terms of the various associations and, well, the compromises of people populating much of the Biden-Harris administration. Give us a quick overview of that, if you would.
Well, I mean, of course, we have, you know, we have the President of the United States himself, who's, through Hunter Biden, taken literally billions of dollars from the communist Chinese. We've got a Secretary of State who is coming fresh from running what amounts to a propaganda front, part of the Chinese United Front activities at the University of Pennsylvania. To go on down this list, you know, we've got a UN ambassador who champions the Chinese role in Africa. I mean, literally the scope of the compromise of this administration by the communist Chinese is just unprecedented. If it was the 1980s and we were talking about the Soviet Union and you had an administration where every one of them was bought and paid for by the USSR, we would effectively think we had been taken over. And yet a great part of the press is just acting like this isn't happening, acting like these people are actually working on our behalf. That's not true at all.
Acting as though it's not disqualifying to have such constraints. And Sam, again, you've spent much of your professional life in the classified world. It's been said by Trevor Loudon, our mutual friend and colleague and fellow member of the Committee on the Present Danger of China, that these guys couldn't get security clearances, as a general rule, to drive a school bus, let alone hold the kinds of offices that they're holding. If those responsible for, you know, the handling of classified information were doing their job, what's going on there?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would agree with Trevor, as usual, you know, across the board on that. That is absolutely true. You couldn't possibly get a security clearance with their background. It's just blatant. It's the chutzpah that's involved here is just staggering, actually, that people get trotted out. They are grotesquely disqualified, and yet we just act like nobody cares. And the press, by and large, just completely ignores this. So we have an entire administration compromised by our number one enemy on the planet. That is literally physically where we are, as staggering as that is. And yet the press is just kind of watching this happen and saying, I have nothing to see.
Well, and these government agencies responsible for handling and protecting classified information as well, sadly. Let me ask you this. When you see this taking place, whether it's the WHO or whether it's Joe Biden, the people down ticket, as they say, from him. Is there any doubt in your mind that the Chinese are exploiting their compromise of these individuals and will likely do so with intensifying efforts in the days to come? It does matter, I guess, is the question I'm asking.
There is no doubt. It matters. Of course it matters. And we haven't even begun to see how far this is going to go. I mean, we talk about the Chinese and Taiwan. Well, you may very well see the CCP move on Taiwan under this administration. And I have zero confidence whatsoever that this administration will stand in their way. I mean, you can see much more dramatic things happen.
Yeah, this raises a point that I feel very strongly about. Did Joe Biden, in the course of his two-hour conversation with Xi Jinping, the dictator of China, not only, you know, recognize, acknowledge, or otherwise conform to his compromised status with the Chinese, but did he say anything that might have signaled that the United States would not interpose objection to, or at least interfere with, an invasion of Taiwan? I think we need to see that transcript of the two-hour conversation to have a sense of what might have been said and a chance to counteract it before it's too late.
Well, absolutely. But I would imagine that at this point, she believes that with good reason that he owns this administration and he's going to basically issue marching orders. And I think the scope of what we may see is very hard to exaggerate. I mean, we could see some real geostrategic disasters very soon.
One of the things that has been operating for some time, and again, you and Trevor Loudon and others have been documenting this, is the degree to which the Chinese Communist Party has been operating, I think you made reference to this, through United Front groups, among other means, inside the United States, including tie-in relationships with the Liberation Road organization and the Freedom Road Socialist organization and their ilk, including groups that they're tied to, the Black Lives Matter organization and Antifa, for the purpose of operating one of their lines of attack, as Kevin Freeman talks about, the unrestricted warfare agenda, namely civil unrest. Your warning in End Magazine and elsewhere, Sam Faddis, about the distinct possibility that the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former police officer in Minneapolis who is charged with murdering George Floyd, may precipitate a new and vastly larger wave of destructive violence at the hands of such groups, and with presumably the support of the Chinese Communist Party in the days ahead. Talk us through that quickly, if you would.
Well, of course, I mean, we don't discuss this again in the media because we maintain a fiction about peaceful protests. And when we acknowledge that there's any violence, it's always just spontaneous. It's the local folks who just rose up. And we have ignored month after month after month these organizations that you've laid out and many others that are out there very effectively organizing, moving a lot of money and directing what's going on. And that hasn't stopped. And it is underway intensely in Minneapolis and other cities right now. And as soon as there is a result in the Chauvin trial, which is can be characterized as unsatisfactory from their standpoint, they will use that as a pretext to set that city on fire. And by that, I mean, there will be, I mean, literally the city is telling its residents they may have to do without police protection and medical care for 3 days. Because that's the scope of the disaster they anticipate. Shelter in place for 72 hours, you're on your own. And that's going to potentially happen in every other major city in the United States. Meanwhile, the Biden administration, of course, is...
And when you say... sorry, hold that thought. When you say that it may happen, that's not just speculation. You're actually seeing signs of preparations for it to take place in other cities around the country?
100%. All day, every day, communications, discussion, preparation... this is an explosive situation, and it is not that it might go off. It is that these groups, which already burned every major city in the United States last year, want it to go off. They want this violence. They expressly discuss it as a revolution, and it is ongoing, and that's how they perceive it.
And I think the thing that's so troubling about this is, among many other problems, of course, is I believe there are people who voted for Joe Biden in the expectation that that would stave off any further mayhem of this kind. And your forecast is that they're going to do it notwithstanding his being in the Oval Office and perhaps expecting that that will give them further latitude to operate in this fashion. Sam Faddis, needless to say, I know you hope you're wrong, as do I, but we appreciate your sharing with us what you think may be afoot, and we look forward to staying abreast with your good help at andmagazine.com, a terrific resource, folks. I hope you're regularly visiting it, as I do, to keep us abreast of this danger and so many others that you're focused on. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us again soon. Next up, Jay Valentine talks about something that he's up to that might help assure election integrity, despite all the efforts made to corrupt and destroy it. Stay tuned for more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and it's a delight to say we're joined by a man whom I've only recently come to know, though we were, I think, roughly contemporaries at Georgetown University back in the day. He went on to great things, however, having established himself as one of the country's preeminent experts on the detection and countering of fraud, something he worked on for eBay and for Medicare and insurance industry leaders combating fraudulent activity. His name is Jay Valentine. He is the CEO of ContingencySales.com and has spent much of his professional life figuring out who's engaged in fraud, how they're doing it, and how it can be stopped. And he has brought these great skill sets to bear, I'm pleased to say, in connection with the recent and fraud-racked election of 2020. And we've had a chance to talk with him a bit about it in recent months, and I just saw him talking about something that he is proposing to do to prevent it from happening again. I wanted to share it with you all. So, Jay Valentine, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you very much, Frank. Happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy to have you here, too, to talk about what you call the no-fly voter list. Talk about both the reference that you're making there, both based on some of your past professional work, but also what's now on offer, thanks to what you're doing at the moment.
Well, Frank, last week, 2 weeks ago, a group of us were visiting together because we've been contacted by a number of people in different states about helping on the election fraud. And during a conversation that was a fairly technical one, one of our members said, well, what we should do is just build a no-fly list for bad actors and bad addresses. Now, it so happens we know a little bit about that because our team built the no-fly list that is in use today. We also built the eBay fraud detection engine, and we've done a lot of large-scale Medicaid fraud and property casualty fraud. The way this works, Frank...
You've countered them, not engaged in it.
And so the way that this works, Frank, is that when we look at the election fraud, what we saw in a lot of the data sets is that Democrats, in particular in large counties, large, highly populated counties, have spent decades bringing in the infrastructure for fraud. Now, that infrastructure means fake addresses, fake people, dead people. We all know it's there. The question is, how can you thwart it? Well, the way you do that is you do it by identifying particularly all of the bad addresses. So what we're able to do is we're able to do something called cross-database search. What that means is we can take databases from the particular state, the Dead People's Database, the U.S. Postal Service Change of Address Database, the Mailboxes ETC, think 50 or 100 different databases, some of which are public, some of which we rent those databases. And what we are able to do is we're able to see what addresses are real and what addresses are fake. And so the kinds of things you see are that 275 people live at this particular address, which is a one-bedroom condo, or that 650 people live at this address, which is a vacant lot. And so our thesis is, if we can shut that down by making it completely obvious to everybody that not only are these people fake, but these addresses are fake as well, then it's going to take bad actors, particularly secretaries of state, decades to be able to bring in all kinds of new bad records. So that's something that we're expect to have some actual visibility to that here, probably in the next month or two.
You're talking about doing something in the way of cleaning up voter rolls that theoretically the states are supposed to do. I'm told that it's also something that H.R. 1, this monster legislation that is putatively going to reform our electoral process, but it sounds more likely to me to be one that will permanently make it fraudulent in the extreme, that will preclude states from doing this kind of cleanup work. So that would make all the more vital the idea of having the private sector stepping in to help, would it not?
Well, the way we see it, Frank, is that the fraud that's being done in the voter rolls is sovereign fraud. It's being done by governments themselves. So we actually know now that several of the swing states have actually already started to amend their voter rolls since the election, changing the dates that some mail-in ballots were actually received because people were able to show that ballots were received before they were even mailed. So we take it as a given that these states have secretaries of state who are, in fact, a criminal class. So we just deal with that. So what we're going to do is, our feeling is, let's make this preposterous. Let's make this so ridiculous that when people can log onto a website, they can look at their street and see that the vacant lot across the street from them had 550 people vote in it. They're going to demand change. Up until now, nobody's had those tools, and we have technology that's not available in a public sector. It's not used by large corporations. It's certainly not used by the government, and we're going to make that technology available. It's a special kind of search technology so that we can let an individual log on, check their address or check a specific address or look across various states and see how many people on my street voted who were underage or how many people on my street voted 11 times. Those are the kind of things that when people can see that and they can actually deal with that, it's going to change a lot of people's opinion about how flagrant vote fraud is.
And the thing I particularly love about this, Jay, is that it will be an opportunity for individuals to become engaged themselves in corrective action.
Well, Frank, that's actually, you are way ahead of the game there. Since we did our first article in American Thinker, we have been contacted by groups in Virginia, New Hampshire, Colorado, Montana, Texas, and they are giving us incredible data that is very, very, very helpful to the work we're doing. These people are doing incredible work in terms of voter fraud work, way beyond anything we have done. And our thesis is we're just going to give them the tools so that they can do great work. But people are out there right now doing wonderful voter fraud work in many of these states. And as we give them better and better tools, they're going to have that much more power. The way I explain it is the Democrats have Mark Elias and the Patriots have cross-database search.
There we go. And that will be the name of the website when it is up and running?
We haven't done any of that yet because we're still months away. Right now, we've just got one or two states running.
Yeah, fabulous. And Jay Valentine, again, is our guest. I want to just ask you about something that I talked about a little bit a moment ago with Kevin Freeman, Jay, because, again, you have been perhaps as, well, bold, vociferous, clear as anybody in America, I think, about the nature of and the extent to which it mattered, namely fraud in the last election cycle, particularly in the presidential race, but down ballots as well. The state of Georgia legislature, as you know, has in recent days tried to fix some of the problems that were particularly evident in that state. And they are now being subjected to legislators and the governor and the state more generally, an immensely powerful campaign aimed at undoing those reforms, those efforts to reestablish electoral integrity in Georgia. Talk a little bit about, you know, both the degree to which that problem demands corrective action and the steps that have been taken by the Georgia State Legislature are both warranted and should be, you know, defended and allowed to operate rather than rescinded and eviscerated.
Well, first, let me say that Kevin Freeman is somebody that we hold in high esteem. So he's doing great work. Second, you are going to see in every single state that passes strong voter integrity laws pushback, and they're going to say they're suppressing the vote, that Black people don't have IDs or don't want to show up. I mean, it's a terrible thing to even say about people like that. And that they're going to push back. And the reason is that you cannot have the agenda of the progressives in the United States win without voter fraud. I think we can say with certainty that Joe Biden would never have been elected president had we not had massive voter fraud. But what we're going to do is, our thesis is, in God we trust and everybody else better have data. And what we're doing is we're going to be showing up and we're going to be saying, okay, let's talk about who's being disenfranchised when 322 people are voting from a single address that's in a vacant lot. And here, let's go look at that. That's the kind of data we want to make available. And that's going to help Kevin. That's going to help legislators be able to fight back. And we want it to impact the 2022 elections.
Jay Valentine, thank you so much for this visit. I hope you'll come back to us again soon with updates, and congratulations on this really important no-fly voter list initiative. Godspeed. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.